Good morning. Thanks for coming, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about this research. I'm going to start with a question, and why are we doing meta-analysis in agriculture? And it's not just because there's lots of cool data, and we have a lot more data, more and more every year. We have all this information, and how do we deal with the information? I think, in fact, what we have are some significant environmental issues and some significant issues in, as we heard on Sunday night, in the growing population globally. We have the environmental issues coupled with a large population on this earth that we have to continue to feed in a sustainable manner. So, big picture, we're not just doing this for the sake of science, we're doing this because we have significant reasons for doing it. So we have to think about the policy context, how are we going to make changes actually happen? If we have good ideas, how do we make somebody listen to these good ideas? And this is the struggle we have as soil scientists in trying to get people to listen to our research. So, the policy context being, as I'm working in an institute for environmental policy, this is where we come from. So we're looking at nitrous oxide emissions as a significant greenhouse gas, and some of the market mechanisms that are being considered or are even starting to happen are these cap and trade systems. And we see the cap and trade system actually happening in Alberta with the opportunity for agricultural greenhouse gas mitigation as an offset. So the big emitters are ratcheting down their emissions. When they can't actually meet their requirements, they can pay agricultural producers to undertake activities that can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And one of these is that could be used is the Nitrous Oxide Emissions Reduction Protocol, also called the NERP, that was developed for Western Canada and is also being being developed to be used across the rest of Canada. In California, they are working on nitrous oxide mitigation and cropping systems to be used in the California ARB regulation, the cap and trade system that's going on there. So these are in process. I don't think there are actually any real on the ground projects in California. It's still a research question, but it's definitely being considered for use. We also have supply chain efforts, and so we heard about the Sustainability Consortium, the Field to Market program, in which Walmart is a significant player in trying to look at supply chain and how do you impact the entire supply chain. So the incentives there are a little bit uncertain, but they're trying to figure out how to make that happen. And we have an executive order from the White House in early spring 2015 where there was the suggestion that the federal government is going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 25% in the next decade. So some of these are real significant goals, and how are we going to achieve those goals? For nitrate, the policy context includes some of the ongoing USDA nutrient management programs and funding. How do they actually target? Which activities are they going to recommend in their programs? And we see also some multi-state efforts to reduce nitrogen losses, especially in this Mississippi watershed, where the states are starting to play a significant role developing nitrogen management plans, trying to say how are we going to actually address this problem. And in those plans and in those programs and protocols, they're trying to figure out what fertilizer management role is there. We also see some water quality trading starting to happen, some small watershed groups where farmers are being paid to undertake certain practices in order to improve the water quality for, say, a town downstream. And those are, we see this happening also in the Chesapeake Bay, some of these kinds of activities. And in the Ohio River Basin that actually provides 30% of the nitrate to the Mississippi River, in that basin, the Electric Power Research Institute won the U.S. Water Prize this past spring for a program that is in a pilot stage starting in 2013, where the big power plants are providing funds because they may have to eventually be under regulatory requirements to reduce their loading to, and they provided funds to pay farmers to actually reduce nitrogen loading to that watershed. So some of these market mechanisms, we need real incentives, we need real reasons for change to happen. So given these things happening and the protocols and programs being developed, they still have these big questions. So they're wondering, well, what practices are going to be the most efficient? We have limited funds. How do we apply those limited funds to these programs? And how do we get the biggest bang for our buck? So our question then that leads to our research objectives is how can we strategically and efficiently encourage management that reduces losses? So do we have a good understanding of what fertilizer management will do in order to affect nitrous oxide and nitrate losses? So what are the fertilizer management effects? And for this project, we were funded again by the 4R Research Fund, and so we are looking at the four R's of fertilizer management: the right rate, the right source, right time, right placement. And what are these effects going to, how do they impact nitrous oxide emissions and nitrate leaching? We also want to look at other management, so we look at crop rotation, tillage, and other management implications, water management, things like that. And then we have the question of, should we be focusing on nitrous oxide or nitrate, or should we be looking at both? And some of that comes from the environmental impact kind of thing. And it depends on where you are. In some economic analyses, it seems that per kilogram lost, nitrate is significantly more damaging than nitrous oxide. But we have this very real climate change problem, too, so that the losses of nitrous oxide may end up becoming more damaging over time. We also want to look at interactions between nitrous oxide and nitrate. Can we actually see whether reducing nitrous oxide also reduces nitrate, or are there cases where we might reduce our nitrous oxide and increase our nitrate losses so that we have these trade-offs? And how does yield play a role? This is extremely important in any of these cases. If we're going to reduce losses, we need to either maintain or increase yield at the same time, or we have leakage problems where those losses are going to happen just somewhere else because that yield needs to be produced at a different location. So then also, how do region and soil and climate play a role in these systems? So we did a very similar thing as Rachel described earlier, except we expanded beyond just the enhanced efficiency fertilizers into all fertilizer management, nitrogen fertilizer management activities. So we were looking for field studies in corn crop systems across North America. So wherever corn is grown in North America, looking at where we actually saw fertilizer management. Wanted to capture data on crop management, on soil and climate characteristics, so we can look at weather temperature and precipitation and how those have an impact, and tile drainage and irrigation, crop rotation, tillage being a biggie as well. So then the data on fertilizer management, any information on fertilizer management, all the information on rate, on placement, timing, source, recording all of that in this database, and then outcome measures of nitrous oxide emissions and nitrate leaching, and then accompanying data on how they were measured, how long nitrous oxide was actually captured, how often it was measured. Those kinds of things too are also really important. So we also then limited it to studies where crop yield was measured because we needed to make sure that this leakage problem is taken into account. So we started with a web of science search using keyword searching various combinations of fertilizer, nitrogen, nutrient management, nitrous oxide, nitrate leaching, and we ended up with over 4,000 studies. And bringing those 4,000 studies down, what do we do with 4,000 studies? We don't have time to read this many papers. So we started with a title review and eliminated those that could not be about cropland nitrogen losses, that were obviously not about cropland nitrogen losses. So they were economic studies, they were life cycle assessments, there were no data. Or they were some medical paper that somehow got included in this. So anything that could possibly have be included based on the title, if we had a question, we kept it. So we ended up with almost 3,000 studies remaining that we then looked at titles and abstracts and further narrowed it down to make sure that it was about corn, that it was in North America, and that it dealt with fertilizer management. And so we could exclude all the international studies. We could exclude the studies that were just dealing with rice or wheat or barley or canola, and those that were dealing with phosphorus or obviously weren't doing any kind of fertilizer management. So were tillage studies, and there was obviously nothing changed in the fertilizer, or they were manure, or they were organic systems with no commercial fertilizer. So that ended up narrowing it down significantly. We ended up with 10% of those had potential for having some data. So those 237 studies then went into our more intense review of the papers, and of which we were then looking for usable data. We ended up with 27 studies with nitrous oxide observations and 22 studies that had nitrate data, and only one study actually fit into both of those categories. So, also then, just to make sure that we captured everything from our Web of Science keyword search, we looked at some of the review articles that came out of that based on the and identified papers that were not captured, and ended up with 150 studies that we looked through, did the abstract review of them, and there was useful data in only one of those studies. So where we ended up with 10% from 237, well, about 20% from 237 to 48 studies, we had less than 1% coming out of the review, out of the studies that were identified through the review. So we then decided that we had actually captured basically everything that we were looking for. So this is where our data were actually located. We can see this map shows in green, at least within the United States, where corn is grown. And the blue circles show where nitrous oxide observations are. The blue circles are nitrate, and the red circles are nitrous oxide. And the size of the circle is telling you how many observations are at each location. So you can see that we have areas where corn is grown where we don't have any nitrate studies, and we have areas where corn is grown that we don't have any nitrous oxide observations. So we can see that our geographic representation is actually, we have some significant data gaps in North America where corn is grown where we don't have any observations of these significant environmental impacts. We also can see that the nitrous oxide studies and the nitrate studies don't overlap very well geographically. So not only did we only have one study that captured both, but we can see this geographic issue here. So again, we're still trying to see if we can find a relationship. We just didn't want to give up. Can we see a relationship between nitrous oxide and nitrate? If there's not a geographic overlap, is there at least some other way we can find a relationship between these? So we had about 400 observations of each, nitrous oxide and nitrate, and we started looking at these observations and the time of when they were done. So nitrous oxide, starting in 1994 through 2012, the median of 2007, actually on average, they were 13 years newer studies than the nitrate observations. So different time frame, different cropping systems, different cultivars, all those kinds of things. So there's some significant differences there. Different types of fertilizer were used for nitrous oxide versus nitrate. A significant array of different fertilizers for the nitrous oxide studies. More comparisons between sources within studies. Nitrate very limited to mostly UAN with a little bit of anhydrous ammonia, some urea, and only two different sources were actually compared in all of these observations. So very little comparison of sources in the nitrate studies. So this fertilizer management, most of the changes in fertilizer management for the nitrate studies were rate. There's very little of other things going on. Then we look at tillage and other management practices, and the no-till is very well represented within the nitrous oxide observations. Hardly there at all in nitrate. tile drainage. 60% of the nitrate observations were in tile drain systems, which makes sense because that's easy to measure nitrate losses in a tile drain system. The nitrous oxide observations, well, maybe they didn't report it, but if they did, it was 1% of the observations were in tile drain systems. So this is a significant difference as well. And then, as I said, only one study with 16 observations actually reported both of them together. So we really can't get a very good grasp on management for one and how it affects the other. So that's kind of the conclusion. So what kind of options do we have for analysis, and is it maybe even meta-analysis? Can we do quantitative assessment of these data? So we can look at the standard meta-analysis procedure and look at effect sizes, assess treatment across treatment response across studies, not consider other variables. We have really unbalanced data, so the meta-analysis procedure gets to be a little bit tricky. We don't have standard error, standard deviation, so we can't weight the data appropriately like a standard meta-analysis would do, whereas those studies that have really tight and small standard errors, those would be given a better weight, higher weight. And so we did some other, we weighted it in a different way, looking at the total number of studies per location and reduced the weighting, reduced the weight of each observation if there were a lot of observations in that one location so that we could better balance the data in that way. And then we can model with multiple variables, and here I'm going to introduce a hierarchical regression model that we use that could assess the response to treatment and include some of our other important factors. So you've seen some of this already this morning. So here's our effect sizes of the observations for which we actually had sufficient number of observations to even calculate an effect size. So we have the number of comparisons and the number of locations. We limited this to observation to treatments to where we have at least 9 comparisons at least 2 different locations. So this is a pretty low bar to be set, where we needed to have 9 comparisons and 2 different locations. So you can see that SuperU, which compared to urea, was actually statistically significant. This is yield-scaled nitrogen losses. So the first 6 are nitrous oxide losses. The last one is nitrate loss. So we can see that for SuperU, instead of urea, we actually have a significantly, statistically significant reduced nitrous oxide loss of about 26%. So that's really significant in reducing nitrous oxide losses. Urea instead of anhydrous ammonia, again, this is only 11 observations at 3 locations, and how does that transfer to other locations? So this is the problem with doing these standard meta-analysis procedures without considering all the other variables. So some of these we came up with some interesting things, but again, there's no consideration of all the other variables that have an effect. So the empirical modeling can include a lot more data and more controlling factors. So we can look at a couple different examples, starting off with the SuperU versus urea. When we did our effect sizes, we had 25 observations at 4 different locations where we actually had a comparison of one versus the other. In our total data set, we actually have 35 SuperU observations and 100 urea observations, six locations that actually had both, and 13 total locations. So we can include a lot more information and start to see how these two relate to each other by including the effect of these other observations. And you can see a really bigger comparison of UAN versus urea from 4 observations. We have a huge advantage in being able to actually compare the two different types of fertilizer. So these multi-level models can test and correct for effects of the other variables and factors, and we can compare observations across time and location and across different crop rotations as well. So the hierarchical regression model then uses this unbalanced data from different studies, where we have some locations where we had over 100 observations and others where we had 2. And how do you then say that those locations, like where Dr. Halverson and all of his colleagues have collected so much data, but that if you give those an equal weight across your analysis, the Colorado data then absorbs everything, and we'd say, and then we start to think that the whole country looks like Colorado. But it doesn't. So these multi-level hierarchical regression models can then deal with this unbalanced data by grouping it into groups, and then we look at the hierarchy and we can end up getting an average effect overall, but we also have an average effect within the groups. So the best grouping that worked out best in our models was to group by location, and so we have clustered them into locations, and then we end up with this average effect for each cluster and our overall effect. And then there's a weighting that happens so that it's based on the number of observations and also deals with the variability as well. So we have we allow then our baseline losses and our treatment responses to vary by location, and so you can see your intercept and your slope can then vary, and you can test as to whether you need to allow your slope to vary or not. In most cases, the treatment response didn't vary by location, but we can allow that to happen in this model. So we have different climate, soils, and management, and for nitrous oxide, for example, our zero N emissions and our response to nitrogen rate were affected by the location. So this is our first set of models. And just because people like to see lots of numbers and everything, this is just to show these are the ones that we tested all kinds of variables, and these are the ones that turned out to be significant. And that nitrogen rate was, of course, a significant. The dependent variable in this case is the log of the nitrous oxide in kilograms nitrogen per hectare. And the yield-scaled model behaved in a very similar manner. So just because we needed to make sure yield was part of it. Temperature, nitrification inhibitors had a negative response. Temperature had a positive effect. Injecting fertilizer had a positive effect for some reason. Well, I guess we'll have to think about that. And maybe that's interacting with some source. Side dress fertilizer had a negative response. So I'm going to put this into a picture because it's way easier to understand when we actually look at a picture. And here are all of our observations for nitrous oxide emissions. We can see an increase with temperature and an increase with fertilizer N rate. So nitrous oxide emissions are in kilograms per hectare on the y-axis. We have fertilizer rate going up on the x-axis. And I've separated these into higher temperature and lower temperature, just cut them in half. So we have those with the higher temperature being the dotted line and the open triangles, and those at the lower temperature locations in July being at the low, being the closed circles and the solid line. So we can see an impact there. But what happens when we actually, why are we looking at all these rates all the way from zero to really, really high rates? Let's look at this data and see if these same sort of effects happen when we actually consider typical application rates on corn. So we're taking a slice of these data. We do find that these same two effects have an impact. Fertilizer nitrogen rate doesn't have as much of an impact. As you can see, there's very little impact to fertilizer nitrogen rate. Temperature did still have an impact, but I wanted to also show you on this graph the impact of timing and nitrification inhibitors. They had the biggest impact on nitrous oxide emissions at these typical fertilizer rates, between 150 and 250. So, for example, you can see that if we have that the blue triangles are dealing with side dress and not side dress. So the not side dress are open, the side dress are closed, and dotted versus solid. And the nitrification inhibitors are open triangles for the brown color, and side dress and nitrification inhibitors have the brown color and they're closed. So the coloring brown says that, yes, they had nitrification inhibitors. Blue, they didn't have nitrification inhibitors. Open means they didn't have side dress. Closed means they did have side dress. So we can see that if they didn't have either nitrification inhibitors or side dress, we had an average of 2.7 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare lost of nitrous oxide at a typical fertilizer rate of 180. if we applied both of those management practices, we reduced it to less than half of the total nitrous oxide emissions. Okay, and the same relationship happened when we did the yield scaled model. So, moving into nitrate, we have a similar set of two models, the first model being all of them, the second model being at typical fertilizer application rates. And we can see, again, nitrogen rates had a significant impact. Yield, again, had a significant impact on nitrate. The precipitation and irrigation was not significant, but it was included into the precipitation because it was related to precipitation. Soil carbon had a negative impact on nitrate losses, and the year of the study had a significant impact. So we can see that over time something was going on in these trials that somehow reduced nitrate losses. So something's happening over time that we can't otherwise explain with our management factors. So this is something that we need to consider as well. All right, so here we have the example of fertilizer nitrogen rate and nitrate losses, and I've separated them into two different soil carbon, and cut that in half for soil carbon. Higher soil carbon are the closed circles and solid line, and you can see lower losses of nitrate when we have higher levels of soil carbon. Take the typical fertilizer application rates again, and we then take that slice between 100 and 280, and we can see then the effect of wet, so precipitated or precipitation or irrigation, the open circles, dotted line, higher losses of nitrate versus dry and application. And then we also had some of the dry observations had aqueous ammonia, and those seemed to have higher losses of nitrate. So what was going on there? It was only a couple different locations. But even when we looked at those locations and compared the urea versus aqueous ammonia, that relationship still held. So that was something interesting. But it doesn't really have a lot big policy impact because it's not a commonly used fertilizer source. But maybe in some cases it might. So we can see what the implications are there. So where do we go from here? We need to address our significant data gaps. So we have geographically limited data, we have very little data relating the two losses of nitrogen, and we have inadequate data for some of our fertilizer management practices. We just don't know and can't make good conclusions and good recommendations to these people asking questions, how do I write this policy? And what kind of things do we make sure to put into protocols? On the farm program design, we do have some ideas that lower rates, of course, are going to reduce losses, but we have to make sure that we don't reduce yield. So lower rates can reduce losses, but not if yield suffers. So we need to think of ways to reduce these rates while increasing yield. So maybe some of these things, like nitrification inhibitors and side dress timing, can allow you to then reduce rates as well. So they reduce nitrous oxide emissions. And we also know that then, as a result of this data, we can see that it's very important to maintain soil carbon in order to reduce nitrate leaching losses. And we may want to focus our efforts on higher loss areas where we have higher rainfall and higher temperatures. So these are, I'd like to acknowledge collaborators and my research assistants and the 4R Research Fund and people who provided original data. Thanks.
Any questions for Allison?
Nicole.
Yes. Your slide where you see the absence of relationship between rates and N2O emissions. Yeah, the slide.
Yep.
Your crop in the between 100 and.
This one? Yes.
Yes. So my assumption would be that when you have hit the optimal nitrogen rate, then you have low emissions. When you are above optimal, then you have high emissions.
Yeah. So Yeah, I know. So maybe we haven't met the optimal. I mean, a lot of the models that are there, are a lot of the information that's talking about really high emissions. Well, we're looking at above 250, right? Like, so, but within this, so should we be reducing by, you know, 20 kilograms per hectare in order to reduce nitrous oxide? Maybe those models are being driven by the extreme of the data. At least in these data, it wasn't showing up as something significant.
I suppose the comment on that is that what you're thinking, if the optimum for one site was 100, and you're looking at 150 ways of its way above optimum, but another year, another location, the optimum might be 180.
Right. So the other thing we wanted to do was to try to figure out whether the end balance was, like, to try to do this on an end balance sort of thing, but the data just aren't available. So we wanted to know if, like, it would have been ideal to do this and compare not yield necessarily, but do it based on, like, look at the emissions and how does that relate to the total end balance. So if we had nitrogen uptake in the crop, like total uptake in the crop, and how much did that relate to the total fertilizer applied, and look at what was in the soil to begin with and what was left in the soil and all that. But that nitrogen uptake in the crop, that data is just not available in most cases. So I think we had 15% of our observations actually reported nitrogen uptake. So,
but
yeah.
How did you fit the end rates in this model? How do you fit it?
So it was a continuous variable. Okay, so the nitrous oxide in this model, the best we looked at linear versus the exponential. So So the N rates are just linear, but nitrous oxide, the dependent variable, is a log. So that's an exponential variable. So then the relationship between nitrous oxide and N rate is not a linear relationship in this model, because the best explanation for nitrous oxide is not linear in relationship to rate. Yes?
Could you break out by rotation, continuous corn versus corn soy?
There were no significant impacts on in the data that we tried. We did do all those tests of all the different crop rotations and tillage, various tillage, and tried to do interactions between them and all that, and none of that came out to be significant. There's just so much variability, especially in these loss data, that it's hard to actually find what's going on.
From your study, could we answer whether in the past quarterly decades, nitrogen, is going up or going down? I mean, under the first question.
Whether nitrogen in the nitrogen loss is going up or going down? Well, based on the research studies that were happening, we did see a decrease in nitrate leaching. So if the research studies over time. So if the research studies are representative of what's actually going on in the farm, maybe we do have a better idea where maybe we are more tightly managing nitrogen fertilizer and reducing nitrate leaching, if that actually is representative. But what was the actual reason for that? It wasn't source, rate, timing, placement. So we don't know what was the reason for that. Maybe it's more efficient cultivars, but then that should be covered in the yield.
Maybe it's 2012 where you have a drought and no leaching.
Yeah, we could exclude 1 year and see if it. But it seemed to be a trend rather than an actual 1 year being different, but I guess we could do fixed effects on each year and see if there was a specific year that had more of an impact. Yeah.
So we need to have a clear answer on whether leaching going up or down in past 2 or 3 decades.
Well, I would say that maybe it is, but I don't. But I can't say that this is necessarily representative of what's happening on the farm. So I guess no, I can't give you a clear answer. But Ardell Halverson told me once it's really, really hard to corner a bunch of scientists in a round room.
Well, we can thank all the speakers. And we have questions. We have time for discussion. If you have questions for any of the other speakers, you have to leave. Any questions for Lisa, Rachel, Nicholas?
My question is about the tillage management system. Have you looked at, as an explanation variable, as the number of years during which the tillage system was established to see if there was, because the assumption is that if it has been established for long enough, the yield will be increasing.
Yeah, we didn't look at it, not in a actual model, okay, unit. So we did compare like studies that last, I think we've been done like three or four categories based on study duration. We do find, okay, this is the top of my head. The effects do differ with duration. The effects from no till will be less negative as time progresses. So there is a significant effect.
That's important to mention it because it makes a lot of difference in the conclusion whether you should be going for no till or not.
Yeah, no, it's true. In our paper, we try to go to great lengths to point out all cases where no till does work. It does work, rather than longer studies, all these cases, until like the very conclusion.
Actually, I have a general question. But since modeling quantity, normally no matter what about the yield or any maybe natural loss, it also depends on the cultivar gene environment and management. I don't know how we interpret those germplasm information in genes study. It's more, I know it's a bit more complex, but this do is any yield or any yield related to plants depends on the gene environment and when how we move forward.
Six different females, all the same male. Male dictates a lot of what you're asking about right there.
Okay.
You get different, it gives you the relative benchmark. This particular hybrid is here. You have six different females, and it may be up just a little bit or down just a little bit, but the male really dictates a lot of that.
Right.
I can put that a different male over here, and I can change that by magnitude
right.
On a UE. Yeah.
Well, that's one reason why we
include
here knowing that some of those changes are happening over time, and I guess that was one of the things. That's also one of the
things. So is that something, so when we publish our data, that in Crop Career come in and say, look at
or include simply is the different company have different certain parts marketing simply divided by a different company.
I would say if you look back to the data historically, the 60s, 70s, 80s, we had as an industry, talking very broad in terms, you had very distinctive genetic components that we all used in the industry. In the last 5, probably 10 years, that genetic diversity out in the industry has more or less coalesced to a large extent to certain genetic pools that the industry is very, is leaning on very hard right now. For example, Lexi are hybrids. The hybrids that can be planted at 24, 26, 27,000 and maintain optimal yield, those are all gone in our industry right now. The more to semi-figs, very high type hybrids, hybrids that can stay at 34, 35, 36,000 that. You try that with a flex beard, it'll fall down all day long. And they cannot handle high hybrids. So we've moved to that as an industry. Those hybrids in general now are more late season in. If you fertilize them, that's why we're seeing more responses to the V10, the pre-tassels, from an agronomic and grower perspective, because they're getting more yield out of the same amount of yen, it's just when you're profitable. Maybe not always cost effective, and maybe not always profitable, you know, to the grower, but depending on the year.
That's probably.
I just have a question for you, or an observation maybe. Do you think that this lack of connection between studies on losses on nitrous oxide due to nitrous bleaching is somehow a unexpected condition of the biological system? Because when farmers need to address either one of them, you cannot minimize the system at two targets. I don't know if you can hear my point, but this one how is it? So do you think that? Did you share that? That's an expected outcome. Exactly. You can usually manage just for minimizing the losses due to one cut, not both.
I don't think farmers are thinking about loss.
Yeah.
Except
that's why they want to minimize
the loss. Right. And the other thing is that a lot of these things metric were done a long time ago. And people aren't studying metric losses for the last year.
Reflects funding and minimum publication units.
Yeah.
So you may have data on both, we're a classic example, but if you're only funded for a student to do one thing, that's what you get the pop out.
And the funding is the climate change though.
Absolutely. That's
so
exactly
why is not in nitrate? Like nitrate is a huge environmental issue. Like, why can't we actually get data on fertilizer management?
And until pretty recently, if you tried to publish a huge mega paper, that wasn't, it was either extremely costly or it just wasn't deemed to be a good idea for many reasons.
So you split.
I think it's also easier to go out and measure into low emissions. I mean, it's time consuming than it is to dig out giant bio drainage studies too. Or
like, to have the industry.
Right, the huge
infrastructure.
Whereas the grad
student
can't go out and sell
colors into a lighting. But here the answer is a lot simpler because, I mean, you started to look at the high application rates. And you mentioned in that high application rate, it's not, there are no differences in the rates and the amount of emissions of nitrates going. But if the issue is environmental, we should be looking at optimums and the lower rates. Because we're putting too much.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what I'm interested in is not in those higher rates, really. I mean, if you look at it from the environmental point of view, that's what we're not interested in, that because we know we have higher losses. So, I think we're asking the wrong question. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what's the cost of polluting? And the truth is that, you know, that cost should be analyzed at a lower rate. Because we're putting too much. We keep doing these studies with, you know, 200 pounds, 200 kilograms of nitrogen. That doesn't make it, you know, we know that from 180 to 250, well, you're going to have a bunch of maybe no differences, but that's not the right question. The right answer is like a lot lower, and then start looking at the interactions with all these the methods and the timing and the 4 hours, whatever. The first problem is that we're putting too much.
Well, and I would just add that we also have to look at the complete. You've got to get what the implant takes up and is hauled off the field, and you have to get both emissions and leaching losses, because simply reducing emissions does not guarantee you would end up in the plant. Mm-hmm. It could have been leached post-harvest. Yeah. Exactly. So you may have done nothing of particular importance with something like that. I think you have to be very
careful. I mean, that's what we want.
It's incredibly expensive. As someone who has pursued that kind of data record for years, you cannot ever get that kind of money. Period.
We had another comment here from 2012, and actually solid nitrogen was lost the next season.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to do extensive time series lines of events.
Yeah.
Another question. The other problem that we have is that we're considering H2O, we're considering nitrogen leaching, both of which are huge. But I know from a theme perspective, 74% of the end fertilizers sold in Canada are now urea or UAN, which is 50% urea. So ammonia volatilization is, I'm just actually amazed at how large it is, even with incorporation, even with injection. So that is sort of a whole other variable that impacts it. So as an example, I ran a study a couple of years ago where, you add an inhibitor, like SuperU, dramatically reduced the ammonia volatilization, but goes up, and N2O emissions were the highest of all the treatments because you've got more N in the soil. Anyways, I'm just sort of making the point that it is a complicated system, but especially with the prevalence of urea and UAN, that is sort of another thing that, unfortunately, we have to sort of consider.
Does it affect the indirect
emissions
of fertilization? But I did a brief research trying to find fertilizer management effect on ammonia initially. And I just did a question. So, I mean, the thought was, can we do another one like this? Do you have ammonia? I was kind of thinking, I'm not sure.
No, there isn't five, yes.
But we do need to consider all of those blocks. Like it's a system. The system is
important. Of course, it's. And that needs to be about a 4-year study. You follow that, you're like, it's take a 12-year and a 13-year effect out, and you get a 14-year effect and a 15-year effect. If you really want to get down to it,
then who's the non-pad, what you guys are soluble.
But there's been quite a few studies showing that when you're above, again, what I said, when you're above the optimal rate, you're probably whatever way it would be, the N2O or N3. So it's a rate issue. The industry has it that the 4 Rs are created equal. I think there's one more equal than the others.
Well, I sometimes think that rate is the one that can be adjusted because the others help that. So it's kind of the.
Very much.
But it's kind of. If rate is great, the one that's more
But the thing is, we're never going to know what the right rate is for any given year. oh, well, everybody's putting on too much to get a really good year, and they didn't put on enough. You know, so then they're going to miss out on income. So unless you have some sort of
bigger
thing,
you're
doing it. Yeah, that's why that sort of stuff is very useful.
You could use isolation. Right.
So speaking about priorities, is that if we want to achieve something, I mean, we need to focus on the big things, the big problems. And again, I think that the stores, replacements, and stuff like that are less conducive to answer the problems we have, pollution, and the ecosystem. So that's why I think really the rate it should be the focus, because as you showed the stores does not explain much of the impact, and when it does, it's really marginal. There's not so much in the source that we can help the environment with. And there's not so much in the placement, there's not so much in the timing as well. So I think, well, I'm pleading for my own case, and I think that thing is a real issue. Optimal real issue.
Is there enough data out there? Those have done benefits to say, international money versus urea versus UA, all the same rate, which one of these fertilizers is going to give more potential nitrous oxide? Which one of these fertilizer sources is going to give us more potential leaching, just by fertilizer source alone?
So there aren't really any type of concentrations, and then the ones that are
right,
yeah,
same
rate of placement. So in our multi-level, like, whole multivariate model, we didn't see any differences between them. In terms of nitrous oxide,
the reason I ask that question is because there's trends that are going on right now in ag with anhydrous generally usage is decreasing, urea is going up.
Yeah.
Are we going to create new environmental problems just because of what we're doing nationally, because of the price of fertilizer or availability of fertilizer or whatever?
Yeah, there didn't seem to be anything
the
enhanced efficiency fertilizer may be any of those related. Yeah. But the other perspective also the same. I've two cases that we have in Mexico, near Mexico City. During 130 years, we have used wastewater from Mexico City to irrigate very close to 500,000 hectares. Yeah. Has been used too much, has been contaminated out of the water. Yeah. Nobody is using nitrogen because all the wastewater from Mexico City is used to irrigate 500,000 hectares. Yeah. Near all of the states, Hidalgo, Tlaxcala, Puebla, etc., and Mexico. That's near Mexico City. And right now, they said, we have to treat all of the water because we have real problems with cancer, leukemia, and everything for all of the guys that are irrigating. Yeah. And right now, it is a political issue, a decision to treat all of the water. And even the producers, they don't want to use treated water. They had to. Yeah. And the other case in Mexico, is in Durango and Chihuahua. They have been used tons of nitrogen during everything, UAN, everything. Yeah. And all of the ecological regions is also contaminated. Yeah. The water is extracted for irrigation very close to 300, 400 liters above. Yeah. It's subterranean. And they say, no more water is used because it's highly contaminated, and right now it's a political issue to try to to some is fact and the break among them. And it was not a political decision. Nobody cares about nitrogen, and nobody cares about anything of contamination or everything. The producer tried to decide to use 250, 300, 500 kilograms of nitrogen, they use it. But there is at the same time like a combination between a political decision and also farmers that they have to take that.
Come on, Nicholas.
I may have a question about the data availability. Let's say we have heard about the problems of doing the analysis out of literature because some things were important, things were missing, standard errors, stuff like that. Of course, that's something I experience as well. But the nice thing is when you can have access to the actual data set from the scientists. So my question is, do you think that in the future we can hope for all scientists to share their data sets to the public so that we have everything we need to work on? I think down the road it will become that way, but I'm sure that we will face a lot of inertia or a lot of problems in having that habit done because it's more work. It's more work for the scientists to achieve that, and there's no reward, no immediate reward. I think eventually it will be a requirement by the funding industry, that funding sources to do that. We are going open government, we're going open data. And I think we have to think about that and find ways to ease the process so that we have guidelines, we have templates, we have standards, we have ways of achieving this so that it's as less painful as possible to do this time. But I will solve all those problems you have mentioned in the literature and analysis.
So I'm looking at the schedule. This is totally germane to your point here. Tomorrow there is a symposium tomorrow morning called Benefits and Barriers to Data Sharing. And it's being sponsored by the Economic Production Discussion. Or maybe see your multiple, so you can detail it, but all these topics look like they're going to be covered there, and there's been a whole hour panel discussion at the end. So that's tomorrow morning, M100 is GH. So, and I know Scott's going to want to say
something. Okay. Right, it's something like an NCBI, for example, that you can send it. All the data sequence of everything, and you can receive any kind of reward as a publication. Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
that's
an excellent
option. Yeah, it's a great too. We talked about that. There are lots of journalists writing that story more often.
Yes, sir.
And it's time. Yeah. But there's a big cultural resistance to it. Like people don't want to share their hard won data for somebody else to go publish. You know?
Especially if they have connections for modeling applications. If suddenly it's out there, it actually may prevent them from writing a second paper, which is more of a modeling paper.
Yeah.
So you're giving it away.
They say, that's not important. Probably not for you at this time.
that is important for all those scientists. Yeah. That is to improve meta-analysis. And they keep that information. It's not too much.
Well, maybe that's a good time. Thank you everyone for coming.